So how many of you have heard of the TV show series called The Good Wife? A few of you? You might recognize the picture from TV promos. It's interesting. The creators of the series, Michelle and Robert King, when asked, how did you come up with this idea of The Good Wife? And for those of you who don't know the story, the main character in the first season has to stand up as her husband, who's a politician, confesses to sexual immorality and adultery. And she stands up beside him at the podium. And the creators of the series were intrigued because 6, 7, 8 years ago, especially in the American political scene, it seemed over and over again you'd have a politician who would either get caught in a sexual affair or some impropriety in governing, and they would be forced to stand up in front of the public and take responsibility, or at least admit to it. Maybe they didn't take responsibility. And they were intrigued because when these guys stood up, there would always be a wife who would be standing there with him, not saying a word, just standing there. And so they thought, what's going through her mind? How is she processing this? And what happens to her after the news cameras go away and the headlines stop? What happens? And so that's the whole premise of the series. And basically, they follow the politician's wife as she tries to pick up the pieces of her life and move on. That raises a question for us this morning, I think. What do you do when someone close to you does something or behaves in such a way that it might even destroy your life? What happens when your spouse has an affair? What happens when a business venture that you're involved in goes sideways? What happens if a loved one gambles away everything they own, including maybe some of your assets? What happens if one of your kids gets involved in gangs? What happens if your parents get divorced? What happens if a loved one or even yourself is living a lifestyle that could destroy you and your family? How do you handle that? How do you stand on the podium beside the person after it all comes out? How do you live life? Here's the reality check. You and I are just one mistake, one misstep, one health problem, one accident, one bad circumstance away from a different life, aren't we? However your life is going right now, however good it is just one thing away from being turned upside down. You could walk out of here, get some news, and have a very different life moving forward. How do you handle that? For those of you who've been here for the last little while, you know we're in our summer series called Stories BC. It was interesting, before the summer started, my kids were sitting around the table one day and they said, hey, Dad, what are we doing for, what are you going to be speaking on during the summers? And I said, well, my series that we're going to do, and we're going to have others speak and stuff, it's called Stories BC. And they looked at me and they go, why are you talking about yourself? That's when the sermon title should have said, Pastor Brent Chapman. There you go. Some of you guys are getting it now. Why aren't we talking about the Bible, Dad? Isn't that what we're supposed to do in church? Yes, Stories BC is stories before Christ, not stories about Brent Chapman, right? So that's what we're in. And so today, I want you, if you have your Bibles with you this morning, we have a chapter to read, and it's going to take a few moments, but if you have your Bibles, turn to 1 Samuel chapter 25, and we're going to look at a very interesting story that involves three main people: King David, or soon to be King David, Nabal, and his wife Abigail. And so we're going to start at the end of verse 1, and it says this: then David moved down into the desert of Moab. A certain man in Moab who had property there at Carmel was very wealthy. He had 1,000 goats and 3,000 sheep, which he was shearing in Carmel. His name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail. She was intelligent and a beautiful woman. But her husband, a Calebite, was surly and mean in his dealings. Important. Kind of sets the stage for what we're going to get into. While David was in the desert, he heard that Nabal was shearing sheep, so he sent 10 young men and said to them, "Go up to Nabal at Carmel and greet him in my name. Say to him, 'Long life to you, good health to you and your household, and good health to all that is yours.'" Basically, David's blessing him. "Now, I hear that it is sheep shearing time. When your shepherds were with us, we did not mistreat them, and the whole time they were at Carmel, nothing of theirs was missing. Ask your own servants, and they will tell you. Therefore, be favorable towards my young men, since we come at a festive time. Please give your servants and your son David whatever you can find for them." When David's men arrived, they gave Nabal the message in David's name, and then they waited. Nabal answered David's servants, "Who is this David? Who is this son of Jesse? Many servants are breaking away from their masters these days. Why should I take my bread and water and the meat I have slaughtered for my shears and give it to men coming from who knows where?" David's men turned around and went back. When they arrived, they reported every word. David said to his men, "Put on your swords." So they put on their swords, and David put on his. About 400 men went up with David, while 200 stayed with the supplies. One of the servants told Nabal's wife Abigail, "David sent messengers from the desert to give our master his greetings, but he hurled insults at them. Yet these men were very good to us. They did not mistreat us, and the whole time we were out in the fields near them, nothing was missing. Night and day, they were a wall around us all the time we were herding our sheep near them. Now think it over and see what you can do, because disaster is hanging over our master and his whole household. He is such a wicked man that no one can talk to him." Abigail lost no time. She took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 dressed sheep, 5 seahs of roasted grain, 100 cakes of raisins, and 100 cakes of pressed figs, and loaded them on donkeys. Then she told her servants, "Go on ahead, I will follow you." But she did not tell her husband, Nabal. I think this is one of those cases where it's better to ask forgiveness than permission. As she came riding her donkey into a mountain ravine, there were David and his men descending towards her, and she met them. David said, "It has been useless, all this watching over my fellow's property in the desert so that nothing of his was missing. He has paid me back evil for good. May God deal with David." I'm not ever sure why he uses third person here, but "be it ever so severely, if by morning I leave one male alive of all who belong to him." When Abigail saw David, she quickly got off her donkey and bowed down before David with her face to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, "My lord, let the blame be on me alone. Please let your servant speak to you. Hear what your servant has to say. May my lord pay no attention to that wicked man Nabal. He is like his name. His name is Fool, and folly goes with him. But as for me, your servant, I did not see the men my master sent. Now, since the Lord has kept you, my master, from bloodshed and from avenging yourself with your own hands, as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, may your enemies and all who intend to harm my master be like Nabal. And let this gift, which your servant has brought to my master, be given to the men who follow you. Please forgive your servant's offense, for the Lord will certainly make a lasting dynasty for my master, because he fights the Lord's battles. Let no wrongdoing be found in you as long as you live. Even though someone is pursuing you to take your life, the life of my master will be bound securely in the bundle of the living by the Lord your God. But the lives of your enemies he will hurl away as from the pocket of a sling. When the Lord has done for my master every good thing he has promised concerning him and has appointed him leader over Israel, my master will not have on his conscience the staggering burden of needless bloodshed or having avenged himself. And when the Lord has brought my master success, remember your servant." David said to Abigail, "Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who has sent you today to meet me. May you be blessed for your good judgment and for keeping me from bloodshed this day and from avenging myself with my own hands. Otherwise, as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has kept me from harming you, if you had not come quickly to meet me, not one male belonging to Nabal would have been left alive by daybreak." Then David accepted from her hand what she had brought him and said, "Go home in peace. I have heard your words and granted your request." When Abigail went to Nabal, he was in the house holding a banquet like that of a king. He was in high spirits and very drunk, so she told him nothing until daybreak. Then in the morning when Nabal was sober, his wife told him all these things, and his heart failed him,
and he became like stone. About 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal and he died. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Praise be to the Lord who upheld my cause against Nabal for treating me with contempt. He has kept his servant from doing wrong and has brought Nabal's wrongdoing on his own head." Then David sent word to Abigail, asking her to become his wife. His servants went to Carmel and said to Abigail, "David has sent us to take you to become his wife." She bowed down with her face to the ground and said, "Here is your maidservant ready to serve you and wash the feet of my master's servant." Abigail quickly got on a donkey and, attended by her five maids, went with David's messengers and became his wife. We have three people in this story, three very different people. We have Nabal, we have David, and we have Abigail. We have the fool, the offended, and the hero. I titled it The Good Wife. I could have titled this series or this message, "What Do You Do When You Marry a Jerk?" Came across this other title, which I thought was very clever by a pastor who was doing a message on this. This is what he said: "The Proverbs 31 woman married to the April 1st man." I thought that was pretty clever, but I wasn't going to steal it. What do we know about Nabal? Verse 2 tells us that he is extremely wealthy. Extremely wealthy. Which means that he would have been known by the people in the area. He was the rich man. Everyone knew who Nabal was. Verse 3 goes on to tell us a little bit more of his character, though. Not only was he rich, but in his business dealings, he was surly and mean. He was not a good guy to deal with if you were trying to do business with him. Chances are he would rip you off. Chances are he would always get the better end of the deal. There was no generosity in him. And if you remember, as you were reading on, his servants really understood who he was. In verse 17, the servant comes to his wife, and in his dialogue with her and tells her about the situation between Nabal and David, the servant says this about his master: "He is a wicked man, and no one can talk to him." What that means is that Nabal listened to no one. He did not take advice from anyone. Whatever he thought was the right way to do things. Whatever he thought he should do, he just did them. In essence, in many ways, he just felt like he was acting like God. And because he had the money and because he had the power, he could do that. No one would stand up and oppose him. Even his wife, as she's talking to David, recognizes this character deficiency in him and calls him a wicked man and says, "Look, he lives up to his name, Nabal, which means the fool or folly. He is a man who lives out what he has been named. He is the fool." When we talk about fool in our context today, oftentimes when we use the word fool, we might mean stupid. Someone who doesn't really is clueless. But when the Bible uses the term fool, it doesn't necessarily mean that. It doesn't mean the person wasn't intelligent. It means that that person is acting wickedly. That that person does not really understand a reality with God. In many ways, what it means when the Bible talks about a person being a fool is this: a fool never sees God at work in his or her life. And this certainly was the case for Nabal. Think about this. Nabal has perhaps the best business season of his life. Did you hear what the servant says? Think about this. You're a business owner, and your business comes in, and the servant comes in, and he says, "Look, we have suffered no losses this year. No losses. We have not been beaten by any competitors. Competitors haven't stolen any business from us. In fact, we were really the only people in town. We did what we wanted to do. We did everything. No one took anything from us." Can you imagine, as a business owner, not suffering any losses, having everything go your way, even the competitors don't steal from you, and then you're there and you're shearing the sheep and you're planning a banquet. And Nabal doesn't even realize that it is God who has allowed David to be there to protect his business interests, his sheep. The Bible has a few things to say about what a fool is and what a fool does. Psalm 53 verse 1 says this, "The fool says in his heart, there is no God." The fool in his heart says, "I am not answerable to anyone. I will not listen to anyone. I can do whatever I want." Proverbs 18 says this, "A fool's lips will bring him strife." Pretty accurate in this case, I think. A lot of strife, I think, surrounded Nabal. I don't think this was the first time Abigail intervened in Nabal's life to spare him and herself and the household some issues. I have a feeling she was very adept of going behind his back and fixing things, and then going and telling him that she'd fixed them. Proverbs 14:9 says, "A fool mocks at making amends for sin." It means that a fool never sees that they should ask for forgiveness, never sees the wrong in their activities, never sees when they hurt someone that they should go to them and ask for forgiveness. Are you married to someone who never says sorry? Never seeks forgiveness for actions that occur? Proverbs 28:26 says this, "He who trusts in himself is a fool." You see, Nabal is the type of guy who would be overbearing to work for. I pity his servants. He is a guy who looked at hierarchy and he's at the top of the chain and he made sure everyone else knew that they were a rung or two or three or four lower than he was. He's the kind of guy that would just be really, really difficult to be married to. And in his prosperity, he'd be the type of guy that would become intolerable, because what happens with that type of person is they actually believe that they have made themselves. They have done everything right and are in the position they're in. They're wealthy because of what they have made. They are self-made men or self-made women. They give no thought to the provision of God in their life. But the servant knows, doesn't he? When he goes to Abigail, he says, "Look, the reason we're having such a good harvest here, that we have all our sheep, we didn't lose any of them, nothing got stolen from us, is because it was David who helped us do that." And in fact, the servant says, "Look, they didn't take anything from us. They actually were like a wall around us. The employee morale was so high. The employees were excited to actually be out in the wilderness looking after sheep." Because in that day, what would happen is you'd be a shepherd taking care of the sheep. You had to protect the sheep, right? If you didn't protect the sheep, you lost your job. You were out of the job. And I don't know what kind of ratios Nabal had. Like, you got to come back with like 99% of the sheep or you're gone. I don't know. Or maybe they divided them up and each shepherd had a certain amount of sheep and the guy who lost the most sheep, he was gone. I don't know. All I know is the shepherd had been out there in the desert, and in those days you would have people who would come and try and steal the sheep. It wasn't just about the animals they had to protect the sheep from. You actually had the Philistines who were raiding and stealing sheep. And so it was a dangerous job. It was not a job for the faint of heart. And you think back, okay, David, I think, understood that, didn't he? He was a shepherd after all. He knew the dangers of looking after sheep. And you see, David, in the very first verse, tells us that he is now in the desert. He's on the run. If you know David's story at all, he has been anointed king by the prophet Samuel. But there is a king already sitting on the throne, and King Saul does not want David to be king. And so Saul has been chasing David, and part of David's strategy to stay alive is to hide in the desert. And so he's been in the desert a lot. But what happens is David has a lot of guys surrounding him. And in this passage, we see he has at least 600. And because of that, he's in the desert. And what he does there is he's not just hiding from Saul, but he's actually acting as a king. He is protecting the people in that area from the Philistines. He is protecting them from them losing their possessions like a good king would. And he's doing that. And the servants acknowledge that. And Nabal doesn't see it. You see, Nabal has a very good year because God has provided him with David to protect his business. But when we don't see God's provision in our life, we will not be generous. So when the time comes for Nabal to be generous to David and in his society and the culture of the day, what David was asking for was not out of the norm. You see, David had provided a service for him. Plus, he was anointed to be king. So if you think about that, one day he would be Nabal's king. He was providing peace and safety and protection. It was not out of the realm of understanding that David would come to Nabal when he was having his harvest, when he is shearing the sheep and saying, hey, do you have anything to spare that you could give me and my men so that we can continue to live? Nabal looks at that and he says, no, I got nothing for you. You see, when we don't see God's provision in our life, we will not be generous. We won't. Because if we don't see how God has provided for us, how God has gifted what we have, and we don't understand the whole concept of stewardship, in that whatever we have, God has given it to us, and we are stewards, and then as stewards before God, we are then to look around and discover how we can be generous with what God has given us. But if you never start with God, if you never start with looking at what God has given you, you will never get to the place where you understand that you need to be generous. And Nabal, as the fool, does not acknowledge God, and he gets nowhere close to having a spirit of generosity. Everything that he has is for himself, and you see that at the end of the chapter when his wife comes back to him. What is he doing? He's having a party fit for a king. In fact, it seems that all the food that Abigail took, which was a fair amount of food, he doesn't even miss it. He doesn't even know it's gone. He has so much stuff. He is just eating and drinking, his heart content and heart full. But he has no space in his heart for generosity. In fact, he insults David when he gives him his response. He says, who is this David? Who is this son of Jesse? You see, if we had time, we'd read further back in 1 Samuel, and you'll realize that everyone knew who David was. Everyone knew who David was. David's defeat of Goliath the giant, everyone knew that. In fact, David was the most well-known and famous general in Israel. He was the guy that they were singing, Saul the king has killed his hundreds, but David has killed his thousands. He was the guy that every little boy in Israel wanted to grow up to be. Everyone knew who David was. And yet, here's Nabal insulting him. He comes along and says, look, who is this David? Who is this son of Jesse? You see, in that culture and even in our day, if you didn't have a name to stand on or if people didn't know who you are, how would you get introduced? You would get introduced as the son of so-and-so, right? But when you are well-known and famous and no one says, oh, that's the son of Jesse, they just say, that's David. Like no one says, hey, this is, you know, I don't even know Henrik and the Sedin's father's name. I don't even know his name. Like no one would come into, if they were here this morning, they would say, hey, I'd like you to introduce the sons of some Swedish Sedin name. These are his sons. Would we do that? No. Because each one of us knows who the Sedin twins are, right? They're famous. They're well known. And here is his attempt to slight him. Say, look, who are you? Like this son of Jesse. And just puts him down. The servant understands that because he goes to Abigail later on and says, look, my master has slandered him, has thrown David under the bus. And he knows that challenge cannot go unanswered, does he? And this is really surprising. If you look back in verse 2, notice what it says about Nabal. Sorry, verse 3. He was a Calebite. Now, for some of you, that may mean nothing. But what the Bible is telling us there is that he is a descendant of Caleb. And if you know your Old Testament history at all, you'll realize that Caleb is a well-known figure in Old Testament history. He is one of the Israelites who took the promised land. In fact, him and Joshua are the only two of the 12 spies that go into the land and say, "We can do this, Israel. We can take these guys." And when they actually start to move into the land, Caleb is the one who goes against the giants in the mountain area. And in Judges 14:14, it says that Caleb followed God wholeheartedly. And here is Nabal, a descendant of a man who wholeheartedly followed God and was known for trusting God and stepping out in faith. And here is a man who is wicked, which I think should give us pause. If you are following God wholeheartedly, that does not guarantee your sons or your daughters will, or your grandsons or your granddaughters will. Because following God is an individual decision. It is a decision that each one of us has to make to orient our life so that we are following Jesus. You can only make that decision for yourself. You can't make your kids do that. And Nabal obviously did not follow God. He didn't. And so then you come to this David. Verse 1, as I've said, tells us that David is in the desert. He's on the run for his life. He's just trying to stay alive, waiting for God to do things so that he could eventually become the king that God had said he would become. He's there in the desert. He's hiding out, but he's not just hiding. He's doing what God has called him to do. He's acting like a king, protecting people, fighting the enemies of Israel, fighting their battles. And as you read Abigail's speech to him, she realizes that, doesn't she? She points out that he is doing what God has called him to do. And yet David, through this circumstance with Nabal, is offended. And he has every right to be offended. And it tells us that he makes up his mind to teach Nabal a lesson, the ultimate lesson, actually. He is going to exact his vengeance upon Nabal for the insult and the offense that he has caused David. And so him and his closest 400 friends with swords are on their way in the middle of the night. They're coming down. And then there's this unique opportunity where he meets a woman named Abigail. And they have this interaction. And through that interaction, David realizes that God has sent Abigail to stop him. And he realizes that the offended needs grace instead of vengeance. He realizes that grace needs to rule the day. He realizes that there are times in our life, well, actually always, it's always better to leave things in God's hands than it is to take them up in our own hands and try and do what we want to do. Always. And he comes to this understanding that he sees Abigail coming out to meet him and talking to him and dissuading him from exacting vengeance on Nabal as a messenger from God. And he realized that there are times in our life when God intervenes in our life, when we have our path set, when we are full steam ahead somewhere, and God suddenly throws an Abigail in front of us. He says, whoa, settle down. Think about this for a little minute, will you? Just calm down. And as I look back on my life, there are times in my life where God has intervened. I had my heart set on something. He brought someone in my life or changed a circumstance and redirected my path. And at the time, I didn't understand it. And at the time, I was maybe fighting against him. But as I look back on it, I realized that it was God's hand in it. And he provided a moment of grace in my life to change my life. Sometimes it can be as blatant as not getting into the car of someone who's drunk, who then goes out and drives and gets into an accident. And we, for whatever reason, you didn't get in. Maybe a friend stopped you, or there was that little voice in your head that said, no, 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 and you listened. And then you see the results, and you said, I could have been in that car. I could have been there. I could have been dead. Or sometimes it's that breaking off of a relationship with someone that you really shouldn't be dating or even thinking about marriage. And you don't understand why at the moment, but years later you do. Or sometimes it's just the simple heeding advice from a person in your life who maybe gives you advice for a business decision or a career decision or a marriage advice or parenting advice, and you look at it and you go, man, that was God spoke to me through that person. You see, the only way we can move from being offended and not trying to seek vengeance when we've been offended is we have to understand that we have to put our trust in God. The Bible talks about this. The Bible talks about God is the one who brings judgment and justice. That's not our responsibility. And that is easy when we're on the outside looking at a situation and we go to a friend, you know what? I know you've been offended. I know you've been hurt. I know you really have a just case for being, you know, seeking vengeance on this person. But God says, leave it in his hands. It's really hard when we're the ones who have been offended by someone. We're the ones who our partner's had an affair with. We're the ones who our business partner has walked out with all the money. We're the offended ones. It's really hard to sit there and go, okay, I'm just going to trust God with this. I'm going to leave it in his hands and not seek the vengeance and justice I deserve. This story placed in chapter 25 is an amazing story because if you know chapter 24 and chapter 26, in those two chapters, David has the chance to kill Saul. The guy who's been hunting him and trying to kill David. The guy who has him in the desert. In chapter 24, they come upon each other and David actually has the chance to kill Saul. He could do it, simply. In chapter 26, after this chapter, he has the chance again. In both those times, David himself stops himself and his men from killing Saul, saying that is wrong. But in this middle chapter, between these two circumstances, he's faced with an offense, and he wants to take that person's life. He wants to have vengeance. And it is Abigail who stops him. And I think sometimes there's a spiritual side of application of this. When we're in the desert, spiritually speaking, if we're not careful with trying to stay connected in our relationship with God, if there are things in our life that are causing us to walk away from God or feel distant from God, we can make poor decisions really quickly. And we can be strong at one moment going, okay, I'm not going to kill Saul. And then the next moment, I'm going to kill Nabal. And then the next moment, I'm not going to kill Saul. And it's amazing how fast that can switch. And I think it's a warning and a reminder to us, no matter how secure we are and how good we think we're doing, that at a moment's notice, something can happen in our life and we can act in a way that we never thought would be possible. Because we're in the desert. And sometimes it takes God's intervention in our life through an Abigail to stop us. And you see Abigail come before David, and she talks to him, and you see David, because he is a man of God, you see his heart soften, and he says, okay, I'm willing to trust God in this. I'm going to step away from the vengeance that I want, and I'm going to let God deal with it. I'm going to let God deal with it. For some of you this morning, maybe I need to be your Abigail. Maybe you're sitting here this morning, and as I've been talking about being offended, being hurt, you're thinking of a situation where someone has wronged you. And you have every ethical right, even moral right, to get back at them, to seek justice, to seek revenge. If you shared it with us, all of us would be going, yeah, amen, go after them. It's your right. But maybe God has you here this morning because he wants me to be Abigail to you, and he wants you to hear this message. You need to turn it over to God and just trust God with it. Let God deal with the situation. Back away from the vengeance. Back away from trying to fix it yourself. Back away. You have Abigail, the hero. What a strong woman we have here. First part of the chapter tells us that not only is she beautiful, she is intelligent. And as I was reading this, I couldn't help but think, I think Nabal saw the beauty in her. I don't know if he recognized the intelligence of her. David definitely saw the intelligence in her and probably recognized the beauty. Guys have a tendency to have that. But she was intelligent and beautiful. We don't know how she becomes Nabal's wife. We don't. Scripture doesn't tell us. But if it was like the normal culture of the day, chances are she did not have a choice. Chances are that she was in an arranged marriage. Her dad would have set something up, and we don't know anything about her dad other than she's named Abigail, which really means father's joy, which means that her father must have loved her or found her to be joyful in his life, and that's why she's named that way. So there probably was some sort of special bond. And I don't know if her dad just was thinking, hey, Nabal's rich. If I can get her married to him, she is set for life. I am taking care of my daughter. Or maybe there was some more, internal motives on himself. If I can have an alliance with Nabal, the wealthiest guy in our region, then that's good for me. And so I'm going to use my daughter to do that. We don't know. All we know is that she is in a situation which she probably did not choose. She is married to a guy that none of us as parents would tell our daughters to marry. Hopefully. Hopefully we wouldn't be blinded by wealth. To say, oh yeah, well, he's rich. You should marry him. No, let's not look at his character. Let's just look at his pocketbook. Hopefully. But she's in a situation that she can't change, married to a jerk. And really, this is a story about how a wife who is intelligent is able to survive in life in a situation she really can't control. And she is more than intelligent. She actually is full of humility and respect. And that is our hero. And our hero comes to David and intercedes with this humility and respect. It's interesting, as she approaches David, she comes to David, she gets off her donkey, she bows down to him. She treats him like a king, doesn't she? He's not crowned king of Israel yet, but she honors him as if he were. And she bows down to him. And she shows him the respect that he deserves. And she acts in wisdom. Did you see how she acts? Notice the things she does in her wisdom. When the servant tells her what happened, she doesn't sit there and go, what should I do? Tells us that she quickly responded. She acts quickly, and she acts and sets out and says, look, get this, 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 and this. Boom, go. I'll be right behind you. And as she does that, she comes to David, and as she's interacting with David, she's telling him, this is what I see in your future. I see you as king. But if you come and kill Nabal, it will have a negative effect on your ability to be king. You see, wisdom allows you to see the future. It allows you to look into what your actions will lead to. It is interesting that David, when he eventually becomes king, he is first crowned king in Judah, and he sets up his first kingship in Hebron, which this is where he is at. He's in Hebron right now. And so think about that. If he had gone in and done all that bloodshed, do you think the people of Hebron would have been really excited to have David as their king, knowing that he could be a ruthless guy, and if you offended him, he could just wipe you out? No. Abigail sees that, and she says, look, you don't want that part of your kingship. You don't want that weighing you down. You don't want that baggage as you become king. And she shares that with him. Not only that, though, she comes to him, and what does she say? She accepts the blame. You notice that? She says, no, no, blame me. I did not see your servant when they came. Blame me. I take responsibility for your offense. Blame me. If you're going to take it out on anyone, take it out on me. And not only does she take responsibility, she comes along and makes restitution. She has all that food and says, look, I've brought you restitution. I'm actually bringing you what my husband should have given you. Please take it for your men. Give it to them. And then she ends it off by asking for forgiveness. Please forgive the offense. Please. Here is a woman who is smart, intelligent, full of humility and wisdom. And yet at the end of the day, she is going to David fully trusting in God. She does not know how David will respond. She's coming to a guy who is bent on killing. And she is standing in a ravine in his path, trying to stop him from killing. And you see the thoughts that are going through David's head just before he meets her. What does he say? He says, you know what? God, if I don't accomplish this, kill all those men, deal with me. Kill me instead. Deal with me. And here she is, and she's trusting God that David won't kill her, and she's humbly coming before him, taking responsibility, asking forgiveness, and making restitution. Here's the thing, when you participate in life with wisdom, others see it in you. When you act humbly towards others, others see it in you. They recognize it in you. The servant in her own house understood. It wasn't Nabal you went to if you needed something solved. It was his wife, Abigail. She wore the pants in the family, right? The servant knew that. David knows that. And in just his short interaction with her, what happens when he finds out Nabal dies because God takes his life, what is his first order of business? I think she should be my wife. Did you see it? I love it at the end of the chapter. Here's the servants, David's servants, his messengers. Listen how it is worded. At the end of verse 39, then David sent word to Abigail, asking her to become his wife. You catch that? Asking her to become his wife. So the servants show up. David's servants show up in verse 40. His servants went to Carmel and said to Abigail, David has sent us to take you as his wife. Something happened in the translation from when David said, hey, go ask her to be my wife, to, hey, David said, you're coming with us to be his wife. The servants understood who she was. They go, man, David needs her. Needs her. When you act with wisdom, people see it. They recognize it. When you act with humility, others see it. And the hero, Abigail, in this story acts and intercedes with humility and respect. As you read this story and as you look at it, you have the fool, you have the offended, and you have the hero. I think most of us want to be the hero, don't we? In life, we want to be that wise person that people come and see and say, hey, yeah, they're humble, they're wise. I want to get their opinion. I want to seek them out. And we realize sometimes that we're the offended party in life. People do stuff to us, right? That's just human life. People will hurt us at different points in life. That's human nature. That's sin. But none of us wants to be the fool, do we? None of us sets out as a kid and goes through teenage years and into early 20s and beyond saying, my goal is to be the fool in life. But here's the reality. You are more often the fool than the hero. I am more often the fool than the hero. Because here's what happens. We act the fool when we don't listen to others. When you don't listen to your wife, or you don't listen to your husband, or you don't listen to your mom or dad, or you don't listen to your boss, or your coworkers, or your good friends when they tell you, you shouldn't do this. You're not acting as the hero then. You're acting as the fool, and the fool says, I can do this myself. I don't need to listen to you. I can just be like Nabal. I don't need to listen to you when you're speaking into my life. More often than not, too, we just don't see God in our life, do we? We don't actually see how God is doing things in our life. We're very much like Nabal that way, aren't we? We don't see his provision. We often overlook it. We take it for granted. And so whenever we don't see how God is moving in our life, we act the fool. But at the end of the day, and maybe more importantly, is when we don't accept the intercession of someone else in our life, we act the fool. You see, as Abigail interceded for her husband and her family, her household, with David, she was trying to save them, wasn't she? And in essence, she succeeded. She did it, other than Nabal got judged and God required payment fairly soon after. But in many ways, Abigail is that picture of Jesus Christ, isn't she? She interceded on behalf of Nabal and the household to save them. And that's what Jesus Christ does for us, doesn't he? Isn't Christ the one who intercedes for us? Isn't Christ the one who stands before God the Father and says, look, I will take the responsibility for sin. I will make the restitution. I will pay the price. Hebrews 7:23. You see, the whole Old Testament system was built on this need for intercession. If you wanted to have a relationship with God, you had to have someone intercede on your behalf. The Old Testament system was sacrifices. You had to have an animal intercede on your behalf. You had to have an animal pay the price so that you could be forgiven. But not only that, you had to have a priest who would offer the sacrifice on your behalf so that God could see it as acceptable. Nabal needed his wife to intercede on his behalf, to pay the price, to make restitution on his behalf. And just like Nabal, we need Jesus to intercede for us. And it is the fool who looks at Christ and says, I don't need you. Hebrews 7:23-25 says this, now there have been many of those priests, talking about the sacrificial system, since death prevented them from continuing in office, but because Jesus lives forever, he is a permanent priesthood. Therefore, he is able to save completely those who come to God through him. Because he always lives to intercede for them. I'm going to call up the worship team because we're going to go into the Lord's Supper. The Lord's Supper is really a reminder to us of what Jesus has done for us on the cross. That Jesus interceded for you and I so that we could have a relationship with God the Father. He is the one who willingly, in humility, gave his life to die for you, to pay the price that God was asking for, to stand in your stead, to intercede on your behalf. And the Lord's Supper is a reminder for us that that's what Jesus did for us. And so this morning, if you're sitting here, we're going to ask you to come forward and receive it. I have some servers who are going to come and just stand at the beginning of at the front of the tables. And you, as the worship team leads us in the next song, just make your way up and take the cup and the bread. And then when you go back down and you just spend some time before God, thanking Jesus for interceding on our behalf. Spend some time just contemplating that as the worship team leads us in worshiping God. Maybe for some of you this morning, you need to get right with God. Maybe you're in a spiritual desert, much like David was in a physical desert. And this is just a call for you to come back into that presence of God, the presence that you haven't felt for a while. Maybe that's what God is asking you to do. For others of you today, maybe it's that chance to back off and trust God and not carry out the vengeance you're planning on someone who has offended you. For others of you today, maybe today's that day. Maybe today's the day you make that decision that Nicole made to follow Jesus. To stop being the fool. To trust that God is the one who can lead your life and save you. Maybe today's the day for you.